Pentagon. The Pentagon has been evacuated. And there, as you can see, perhaps the second tower, the front tower, the top portion of which is collapsing. Good Lord. There are no words. You can see large pieces of the building falling. You can see the smoke rising. You can see a portion of the side of the building now just being covered on the right side as I look at it, covered in smoke. This is just a horrific scene and a horrific moment.
Welcome to Right This Way, the weekly wrap-up show starring the hosts of Take That Radio. It's fun. It's enlightening. Looking for a common sense point of view in this topsy-turvy world we live in? You found it. And the fun begins right this way.
Hi, I'm Wendy Sullivan from GirlOnTheRight.com. Kind of a strange night in the studio tonight. With me is Jimmy Bice from The Delivery, Ben Swenson and Andrew Lawton from Right This Way, and my co-host from Brass Balls Radio, Kimberly Haney. We're talking about where we were a decade ago. In my case, it was a Tuesday morning. I was sleeping in late, and my future husband, boyfriend at the time, was staying with me. Phone rang. I slept with earplugs, didn't hear the phone. He got up, tottered out to the back room where the phone was, missed the call, checked the message, came back, sat down next to me on the bed, said, "Honey, wake up. We have to go to Heather's house. The U.S. is at war. They don't know who they're at war with. The World Trade Center has been destroyed." And I pulled out my earplug, and I looked up at him and basically said, "What did you just say?" And he goes, "Just get dressed. We have to go to Heather's." The rest of the day, weirdly, was spent with unemployed journalists on the busiest news day of my generation, possibly the busiest news day since Kennedy had been shot. And there I was in a room with all of these people who should have been off filing stories on this. And we're sitting around and we're drinking Bloody Marys. Came home that night on the subway, on the metro in Montreal, looked down on the floor of the metro and saw the Twin Towers on fire on the cover of the Montreal Gazette. And it took me a few minutes to understand why I found that so strange. It occurred to me a little later on, just before I got off the metro, the Montreal Gazette had never in my lifetime, and if I remember correctly, never since World War II, printed an afternoon edition. That kind of drove home to me just how big this was. And in the coming days, I started to see the shorthand, 9/11. And to me, automatically, my brain went to 911, the emergency number. It actually took a couple of days for me to realize that it was shorthand for September 11th, the day, of course, that it had happened. September the 12th, I stood in line for 5 hours to give blood. By September 14th, when I went to the multi-denominational service at St. James Cathedral on St. Catherine Street, we knew by then that my 5 hours in line was all for naught. There were no survivors when the towers went down. If you didn't get out in the first few minutes, you didn't get out. It was just unbelievable to find out that 2,996 people were killed on September 11th when 4 planes were hijacked. So that's why I'm sitting tonight with my friends to talk about where we were and what we were doing. For me, I know that it changed everything. I went from being apolitical to very political. I went from being unaware of what happened in the news to being immersed in it, to going from having, you know, the normal child fear nightmares of monsters under the bed to having dreams of being pushed off and out of the windows of the Twin Towers. And now, 10 years later, we're faced with a hole in lower Manhattan where in the skyline, there used to be two gleaming golden towers that the sun would catch. So, Jimmy, I'm going to turn it over to you for a minute. You actually work in Maryland, not too terribly far, maybe a 40-minute drive from the Pentagon, and you work for the police services as a dispatcher. Tell us a little bit about your Tuesday morning.
Well, I do. I work for a natural resources police department, which is unusual in my state because we're the statewide police department that has the boats. So if it happens on water, we're it. And my coverage area at that time actually covered all the way up to, for those of you who know the D.C. area, all the way up to the Woodrow Wilson Bridge, which is right up to the Washington, D.C. line. It's by National Airport. The bridge itself is a fairly major artery, and we also cover the Chesapeake Bay Bridge and a number of kind of important places. And it was a pretty quiet day. It was a really quiet, beautiful day, and there wasn't a whole lot happening. And my bosses were in, and we were just kind of doing, you know, normal administrative caretaking work. No big deal. And I got a call from one of my officers who said, "Hey, if you have a TV there, you ought to turn it on because something just happened up in New York." He said, "I think a small plane hit one of the towers." So I hollered at my boss, and we have a television upstairs. So we ran upstairs and brought it down to my office and set up a couple filing cabinets, hooked the cable up to it, and we're watching. And the more we watched, the more we realized that this wasn't a small plane. This was a big plane. And so we were just kind of half watching because we're thinking, you know, that's really terrible. That's a horrible accident, but, you know, it's in New York and we'll keep our eyes on it just as a matter of kind of news interest. And then the second plane hit. And not long after that, well, when the second plane hit, I hollered again, got my bosses in, and I told them what happened. I said, you've got to see this. So this can't be an accident. There's no way in the world this can be an accident. Something is really, really wrong. And we weren't getting any news. We didn't get any news from kind of our upline emergency response people. Nothing was hitting our alerts or anything like that. So we kind of started brainstorming. We said, "Look, you know, what if this is an act of war? What are we going to have to do? What are we going to have to protect? Where are we going to have to patrol?" And while we were actually kicking the ideas around, the first tower fell. I think it was the North Tower. Mm-hmm. And it was as if you had poleaxed us. We were utterly silent. I don't know that I could have said anything. There was no way for me to actually process what I had just seen. Because I know, and this, by the way, is something that doesn't get reported very often about 9/11, because we think about 3,000 dead, but we don't think about what could have been. And I know that both towers of the World Trade Center have thousands. I think the number is somewhere around 15,000. I'd have to look it up. But somewhere around 15,000 people work in those two buildings, not counting World Trade 7 or any of the other buildings around, just the two big ones. And I know that they get at least that many people through as tourists every day. I saw that building come down, and all I can think of was, that's 10,000 people. That's 10,000 people gone, just gone. Nobody's going to survive that. And then the second one fell down. And I don't remember whether it was my boss or I, but one of us said, "We got to get to work. We've got a lot of work to do." And we spent the rest of the day, I kind of barely remember any of the news reports after that, because we spent the rest of the day taking all my officers and essentially rearranging the schedule for 60-some-odd police officers so we could go on 24/7 patrols. We didn't know what the actual attack targets were. We heard about the Pentagon, and we heard about another plane that may be headed toward D.C., and that turned out to be Flight 93 that went down in Shanksville. We didn't know what the targets were. All we knew was that we had some places that a terrorist was likely to hit. And we have a nuclear power plant in our coverage area. Oof. We have Calvert Cliffs Nuclear Power Plant, and it sits right on the water. And we have a couple major bridges. We have some other pretty significant power stations, or coal power stations. We didn't know what they were after, but we knew that we covered up right up. We came right up to D.C., and we knew that things were going to start shutting down. And in fact, the Potomac River, we shut the Potomac River down. No boats anywhere. No boats. Only our boats. Only emergency boats. And I came into work at 8 o'clock that day. Went into work at 8 that day. And by the time I got home, it was 10 or 11 o'clock. It was late. It was really, really late. Essentially, one of my bosses and I had redone the whole schedule, had run these full operations, and we were fielding calls from people. We fielded calls from my mom. I don't want to make too light of this, but my mom called me. And my mom was really concerned because she knew I worked in a police station. And she said, "You, Jimmy, are you okay?" "Mom, I'm fine. I'm really, really busy, but I'm fine." She said, "Well, I saw the news, and they're saying it could be terrorist attacks. You know, are you going to be okay there?" "Mom, I'm pretty sure that on the list of Osama bin Laden," I remember Osama bin Laden at the time, it said on the list of Osama bin Laden's priority targets, "I don't think my office is on it. I'm going to be okay, I think." So, but it was sweet. My mom called me, and I went home, and it was late, and I had to come back to work the next day. I vaguely remember stopping on the way and picking up some dinner. And I got home, and I flipped on the television, and I flipped on my computer, and I ate dinner. I think I ate dinner. And I remember being tired and numb from the whole day. And at some point I went to sleep, and I got up and I went to work the next day. And it was very much the same thing. Details still weren't coming in. We were still hopping, still busy, trying to cover, in a lot of ways, trying to kind of guess in advance what our job was going to be. But we still didn't know. We still had no idea. And there weren't a lot of us. And we pretty much had to shut down the Chesapeake Bay and the Potomac River. And that's a lot of water.
Mm-hmm.
And our guys are going on 24-hour patrols. So being a support guy, doing all the logistics stuff. And it was, I think it was 3 or 4 days before I had my head on straight again. I don't honestly remember a lot of the details of those 3 or 4 days, except that I just remember going home every day, turning on the news and watching the news until I went to bed, and then getting up again, turning on the news to see if there had something else had happened. It wasn't until later that the thought really coalesced in me. And it's, by the way, it's a thought that I still have today. And, My thought was, somebody has got to pay hard. Somebody has got to pay hard. And I still have that today. I still, and this may be selfish. I hate these, you know, what do I feel about it? Because, you know something, to be honest with you, I'm going to go off script a little bit. I don't think a whole lot of people care what I particularly think about 9/11. I don't know. Maybe some of my friends do. But I know that for me, not enough of the people who were behind that have paid hard enough. And that's kind of what I was doing and where I am on it. I will tell you this very briefly. How much time do you think I have left, Wendy?
Plenty of time. Go ahead.
All right. Let me see this, because this is something that bugs me, and this is something that is likely to get me emotional. I have seen a few documentaries of 9/11, of the first responders, the transit authority officers, and the NYPD guys and the firemen who went up while everybody else was coming down. And let me tell you something. Those guys. And the guys, some of the security officers for the companies inside the buildings, saved tens of thousands of people.
Yes.
It is not an exaggeration. But one of the things I've never seen talk about, one of the aspects I've never seen anyone really discuss, is what happened in the New York Metro Police Department's 911 center that day. Here's what I mean. I've been a police dispatcher for 22 years. I've done this a while. And I have talked to police officers in very stressful situations. I've talked to officers who have been in the middle of chases where the car in front of them ran another car head on. And they've had someone die in front of them. I've been in front of officers who have had people draw down at gunpoint on them. I've talked to officers in some bad situations. I cannot fathom what it would be like for me to have to hear a police officer's last words on earth.
Yeah.
Those dispatchers did that not once, not twice.
They heard it all day.
Hundreds of times. They literally, and let me tell you something, the link between a police dispatcher and a police officer, a lot of people don't think it's there, but you know something, these are guys you talk to every day. A lot of times you kind of go out and hang some with them. You know who these guys are. You get to know them. You get to know their families. And all of a sudden, these guys that you have radio contact with, and one of the things they drill into your head incessantly as a police dispatcher, and they do this with police officers too, about their dispatchers. They say, guys, you are those police officers' lifelines.
Yep.
You are their lifelines. And to sit there and to hear radio after radio go dead, one right after the other.
God.
Over and over again. And no, and going through your head, you are their lifeline, but you can do nothing.
Yeah.
You are their lifeline.
You're powerless. And you know what, Jimmy?
I'm begging somebody with some chops to get into that call center and let these people tell their stories. Mm. Because I guarantee you there are people there that heard dozens of last words on earth, and nobody really remembers them. And we ought to, because I'll tell you this, I'm a pretty hard, cynical guy when it comes to my job. I've heard a lot of bad stuff, and most of it, I can turn my heart into stone. It's a professional thing. It's what happens. Mm-hmm. If that happened to me, if I had been there, I would have done my shift, gotten my relief in, walked into my boss's office, and said, I'm done. Don't look for me tomorrow. I quit. I'm out. I'm finished. That would have cooked me forever. I would not have gone back. And I guarantee you that there are a lot of guys like you. I know so many of them went back the next day. They went back just a few hours later. They went back. I couldn't do it. There's no chance I could have done it. But those people are heroes. Those people deserve medals. Those people, we ought to know their names too.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing that gets me, is that we gotta, my God, those people, those responders and those people that sat back on the radio and had to hear them die and couldn't do anything about it. And then they had to go to work again the next day and the day after that and go back to work and handle the routine stuff, you know? Go back to work and handle the complaints about doors that were unlocked and car accidents and kitties up a tree. And they had to handle that. And how? Damned if I know. Because that had been it for me. I'd have been done.
I think the guys that are left behind are the people that we're not thinking of. And I know Kimberly and I talked a little bit about this on Brass Balls, but there were not just family members and children and survivors left behind, but there were, you know, as you say, the guys that had to hear it happen, and the deli across the street that was shut down for 6 months because of the dust and the asbestos settling. And
well, there were cops that were left behind too. For, you know, there were guys who were out on sick leave. Guys who were actually, there were some guys who were out of town who came back and their whole station is gone.
Yeah, ladder 19, I think. Most of the station was decimated. They had to rehire everybody.
Yeah, I mean, and there are officers there who just, and it's, you know, yeah, they weren't there, but man, all of a sudden you have to go back and nobody's there? No, nobody? that your pals, the guys you hung with and played poker with and told really horrible jokes with and went through life and death together, and they're gone, and you, where were, you know, I, you know, those people, I just, I want those dispatchers one day to get their due, because God is my witness, they earned it. They earned every freaking penny of their meager paychecks. And that's, and if we keep talking about it, you're going to lose me. So
I'm about to start crying, but I do want to turn actually to Andrew, because Andrew, you were a kid.
Yeah,
you're the
youngest
one of our bunch.
I was in high school when it happened, and only just. And when it happened, I think there were two problems. I didn't find out about it until the end of the day. I didn't find out about it until around 3 o'clock that day. And I think it happened, the first plane hit at
9:50.
Yeah. So I would have been 8:50. So I would have been in class then. And so, okay, I'm going about my day. It's a completely normal day. And when we were first told about it, it was over the intercom near the end of the day. And it was all these things that I'd never heard of before. It was the World Trade Centers. I didn't know really know what they were. It was, so, you know, planes going in. It was New York. Like, it was all these little concepts that didn't really make sense to me, things that I'd never been exposed to before. And they didn't do anything about saying who it may have been or what may have been going on. But it was presented in a very cavalier way. It was, so, you know, if you want, like, the exact words that the principal said were, oh, if you want, you can come to the library and there's a TV on there and we can all watch history in the making. And it was said not with any sort of, I don't think it was that the principal didn't care. I think it was just that what was happening was just so surreal that no one knew what to do. The only thing that people could do, especially in where I was in little old London, Ontario, the only thing we could do was just watch. There was nothing to do there. You couldn't comprehend it. You couldn't help. I mean, even most of the people in New York couldn't help. The ones who did, God bless them, they're heroes. But all we could do was watch. There was no sense of control about even our own lives at that point, because the world had literally stood still, and I didn't understand what was happening. Even over the next few days, it was something that I was hearing words. I was hearing, oh, you know, terrorism, planes, Pentagon, but I didn't really know what was happening. And I mean, you're right, Wendy. I was a kid, but I was not informed about anything political in the least. So I didn't know what to make of it. And I think really the first time that I ever understood and fully comprehended what had happened was about 2 weeks later, where there was on the television, I was flipping through channels, and I saw a video on one of the news networks in Canada. It might have even been CNN, actually, at the time. And it was a person falling out of a building.
Mm. Oh.
And that very image, that to me was the moment that I understood what was happening. It wasn't hearing about the thousands of lives lost. It wasn't hearing about the buildings falling down. It was seeing one life being lost that really made it hit home. It was seeing, and I didn't understand this at the time, but it was seeing that one person had no choice but to just jump. Mm. And this is before I knew what terrorism was. This is before I knew or really cared how this happened. But this was how I realized that something bad had happened, something huge had happened. And it's interesting, the New York Times actually has an interactive map where you can go and you can place a little pin on where you were when you heard the news. And I zoomed in to London, Ontario, and there was about four pins in there. But interesting was that one of the pins that was in that map was from the exact same school that I was when I heard the news.
Oh.
Someone had pinned the same address, and I saw the name, and I'm going to see if I can find that person and contact her and see kind of what really what she was thinking and if it was the same person I'm thinking of. But, you know, I was looking around, and no one my age knew what was happening. And I think that's a huge huge, huge telltale sign of just how bad this was, is that you had this whole generation of kids, this whole generation of teens that were seeing something completely unprecedented, that their world, the world that they were growing up in, would change forever because of something that no one even understood. And that was and is the thought that's changed my life and how this has changed my life. It's that that affected how an entire generation lives. And I'm not talking about the political stuff. I mean, yeah, there's things that are different about the functional ways of life, like airport security and things like that. But in general, the way that everyone interacts with each other, the way that people trust each other, the way that people view events, the way that people view movies, songs, everything, everything has changed.
We're seeing everything through a prism of that Tuesday morning.
Absolutely.
And Andrew, I don't mean to belittle the fact that you were, you know, just a kid, but I know a lot of schools, and we always roll our eyes when stuff like this happens, but bear with me. Did your school bring anybody in to help kids understand what was happening, or was that not done in Ontario?
It was mentioned once on the intercom and never again.
Wow.
Except maybe by a couple of teachers casually, but the school itself did nothing.
Unbelievable. We're going to wrap up the first half, Andrew, and we're going to come back. I want to talk to Kim and I want to talk to Ben about where they were. And then I think at the end, I want us all to talk about what we're doing now in relation to what we saw that morning. Because I think a lot of what we do in terms of being bloggers and podcasters and journalists and all the different things that we do, I think a lot of us, I know myself, I know you, Andrew, might not be doing these things today had we not woken up that morning to those images. So we'll be back right after this with more recollections from September 11th.
You and your family are connected by routine and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if your day's routine is disrupted and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, be ready. Get a kit. Make a plan. Be informed. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
Some people say it's what we deserve for sins against God and for crimes in the world. I wouldn't know, I'm just holding the fort. Since that day they wounded New York.
Oh my God! Oh my God! afraid.
Welcome back to the second half of Right This Way. I want to finish up with Andrew Lawton, who, by the way, on the break reminded me that the show we're on right now is Right This Way. The show he does with Ben Swenson every week is Strictly Right. I'm very sorry, Andrew. What were you saying about having, you know, changed and your recollections from September 11th?
It's not even the recollections so much as just the significance of it. I mean, I'm a big, everyone who follows me on Twitter knows I'm a big Friends fan. And Friends is obviously set in New York City, and I have all of the seasons on DVD. And I've been watching, there was a season that I've been watching over the last couple of weeks, and every now and then they'll do this panoramic of the city. And the season that I was watching was in the year, filmed in 2000. And every time I see the World Trade Centers there, I just feel this tightness in my heart and the sinking in my stomach every time, because not only is there, as you said earlier, it's a big hole in Manhattan. I mean, those towers don't exist. That timeline or that skyline is gone, but it's a hole in a lot of people's hearts. It's a hole in a lot of people's lives. And I can't say I've ever really gained profound insights from watching Friends before, but if nothing else, I mean, just seeing the skyline itself is so symbolic of the effect that it's had on people's spirit.
I certainly can't laugh at you for that, because I had the same experience. I moved over to Scotland in December of 2001, and Channel 4 was carrying Sex and the City, which I'd never seen when I was living in Montreal, just because I wasn't a big TV person, but my ex-husband was. So the TV was always on. He's like, oh, have you ever seen that show? It's a chick show. And the opening sequence is, you know, Carrie Bradshaw walking through the city, walking across the bridge, and seeing the towers in the background. And I remember watching it for the first time, getting up and walking out of the room. Now, okay, it's understandable that people would do that because it wasn't a great show. But let's be honest, I did it because I was seeing something that literally kicked me in the guts. So, you know, to say that you do the same thing with Friends is I think it's actually quite common. I was talking to somebody, I don't even remember who, on Twitter about the very same thing the other day. Do you get a knot every time you see the Twin Towers? And yeah, I still do. Kimberly, where were you? I mean, were you living in Atlanta at the time?
I was living in Atlanta at that time. And as most of you folks know, I am self-employed. I have, at that time, I was still working for the company that I would leave in 2001 and become an independent contractor for. But I've worked from home since 1993. So not that I'm a recluse or anything like that, but I was sitting in my office, and at that time, you know, really as far as instant messenger goes, AOL was it for the most part. You had that and ICQ, okay? And because I worked with, you know, so many people across the country, we used that as, you know, just kind of like we use Twitter now, you know, to get in touch with people instantly. And I'm sitting there. My kids have already gone to school. I've dropped them off. My son was a senior in high school, and my daughter was in the seventh grade. And her birthday is September 12th. Okay. She was turning 13 the next day. So I had started preparing the cookies and the stuff that she would take to school the next day, you know, for her birthday party. And, you know, we have a little freedom when you're working from home. And I heard my phone ring and I'd missed the call, kind of like you, Wendy, you know. So I go into my office, which was right next door to the kitchen. And sorry about that, guys. I got all of a sudden have an echo. sorry, you cut me off. I'm like, wait, what's talking to me? But, so I walked into my office and checked to see, you know, what was going on. But nobody had left a message. And I saw up on my computer screen that there was a instant message from one of my customers that said, if you're at home, turn on the television. And this was like right at 9 o'clock. So fortunately, the way my office was set up, it had like a glass French door sitting, you know, so I could actually see the television in the corner of the den. So I went in there and I turned it on. And I remember I turned it on to the Today Show. And I could see Katie Couric and Matt, what's his name? And they were, you know, somber. And they said that, you know, a small plane had just hit one of the buildings at the World Trade Center. And at that time, they were still saying it was a small plane. And nobody really knew that this was an act of terror. And so I'm watching it and I'm sitting at my desk and I'm thinking, wow, this is horrible. Things are crazy on the ground and they're trying to get news teams out there. And, you know, within like, 30 minutes or so, I actually saw the plane, the second plane, hit the tower live on the Today Show. And at that moment, I knew that we were in big trouble.
It went from being a news story to an American reality. It became something that was so much bigger than something interesting to watch, like you say, on the Today Show. And I think everybody that's, I mean, I didn't see it happen in real time. I watched it after 10 in the morning. So the towers were already down, but you watched it right
I
then
saw
there.
It happen. Yeah. I saw the second plane hit the tower. And at that moment, I mean, it was like I went into, I can't even really describe what you would call this mode, but I went into mom mode. Okay. All I knew is that we were in trouble. And who knew, you know, what was going to happen? Because I live in Atlanta. And if y'all remember the 96 Olympics when the bomb went off in the parking lot,
yeah,
I was not very far from that area. I heard that bomb go off. I was actually in the Atlanta airport parking lot when that went off. So I had already been through a pretty close to home act of terrorism. So mom mode, immediately grabbed the dog, got in the car, drove to the school, picked up the youngest one first because the son had his own vehicle. Went by the school, said, I want my son dismissed right now. And they're like, what's the reason? I said, you don't need a reason. I'm his mother. Bring him out. I got Matt. I said, we're going. Just meet me at the house. And he's like, what's wrong? I said, just come straight home. And thankfully, we only lived like, you know, 3 minutes from the schools. Very close proximity. But that was the only thing I could think of was to get my children with me.
So that you would know where they were.
I needed them there. By the time I got back to my house, the Pentagon had been hit. And like Jimmy said, they had dispatched the fighter jets to go after Flight 93. And I just remember being glued to that television set for the entire rest of the day. And I could not wait till my husband, at the time it was my ex-husband, but I couldn't wait till he got home. And it took him hours to get home because the traffic was so bad in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. So once we had the family unit there and everybody was together, all we could think about was getting, you know, we ended up all at my best friend's house, just watching this unfold. And all I remember thinking is, you know, how grateful I was to have my immediate family there. Because I have a very good friend whose husband worked in the second tower. And she actually lives here in Atlanta now. But at the time, she was living in New York. And she couldn't find him for 4 days.
Oh, God.
4 days she searched that city. 4 days she listened to President Bush tell them, I will make this right. Don't ever speak unkindly about President George W. Bush in her presence ever. it is not done. And if you do, she will take your head off. And she lived that. She lived that. And to hear her deal with that and to repeat that story will absolutely put you on your knees. And, you know, after that, I don't remember much after that, watching Building 7 fall. And at that point, I put my children to bed and I said, tomorrow's another day. And of course, to this day, you know, we kind of give Tiffany, my youngest, we kind of try to make her birthday a little extra special. Because, you know, she was turning 13 that next day. And, you know, in the mind of a 13-year-old, it was like, you know, this really sucks because I didn't get to have my birthday party.
It's a strange way of looking at it, but the reality is, I mean, she's not that much different in age from Andrew. So for this younger group of people, it's something that happened during the school day. They didn't get a hell of a lot of information on it, and it just kind of went in some ways over their heads. And of course, you know, Andrew's, you know, taking it upon himself to learn more about it. Your daughter grew up in a household where I'm sure she understood lickety-split what happened. But there are probably a lot of kids around the same age that just kind of don't remember that much about it, except maybe, you know, their parents holding them a little tighter before bed that night or something. Well, so
we talked about this earlier today, and I will just say this one thing. My grandfather, who raised me, often spoke about Pearl Harbor and how they felt when that happened. And I get it.
This was our Pearl Harbor. Absolutely. Yeah. And Ben, I definitely don't want to leave you out. What was going on that beautiful, blazing blue Tuesday morning?
Yeah, well, I'm actually on the opposite end of the country. I was actually supposed to be in Washington, D.C. on 9/11.
Oh, God.
And I canceled the trip for whatever reason. And I was actually at my grandmother's house. And I was, like you, sleeping in. And my grandmother is a bit of a news bug. And I hear from the living room, you need to come out here, Ben. There's something strange going on. I think this might be history in the making. And prior to that, I had actually had a very, very hard time going to sleep the night before. I can't explain it. I had a bad feeling, and I didn't know why, but I had a bad feeling. And so as soon as she said that, I jumped out of bed and ran out to see the building on fire. The first plane had just hit, and there was just mass confusion. And at first, it sounded sort of just like a small plane, an accident, and yeah. So I thought, oh, this is odd, but you know, this doesn't seem like any major issue. I mean, it's a big deal, but it's not 9/11 at this point.
Right.
And so I think I went and got some breakfast or whatever and sat down to talk to my grandma. And at that moment, the second plane hit. Yeah. And I remember thinking, this obviously can't be an accident. And this is not a small plane. This is a very large plane. And thinking, what else is going to happen? What next? And I actually remember praying at that very moment, dear God, don't let them take the White House. Because yeah. I had this image flash through my head of the White House in flames and the country in anarchy. I mean, that it was sort of one of those moments where you get this entire sort of microcosm of a view in a split second.
Yeah.
And so my immediate reaction was just, don't let them take the White House. Little did I know at the time that there were
they were trying to.
They were trying to, exactly.
That actually prevented that from happening. So, to me, again, I'm kind of like Jimmy. I don't really think anybody really cares that much about what I was doing. So I'd actually like to shift focus really quick. There are two things that really stick out to me about 9/11. One, like Andrew said, the jumpers. When I saw that first jumper, I actually broke down and cried. I could not imagine the choice that these people faced to either, you know, burn alive or jump to their death. And that immediately woke me up and, you know, it made it real in a way that that somehow seeing the burning building didn't. And I, you know, the thing that really bugs me though, and we talked about this a little bit on Strictly Right yesterday, is did you guys know that Michael Bloomberg is not allowing the first responders at the ceremony?
Yeah, we talked about it earlier tonight.
That is so insane to me and so disrespectful. Mm-hmm. And so I honestly, I don't think there are words to describe how horrible that is. So, I don't know, kind of like you were saying earlier, Jimmy, we need to find somebody with some clout to get a hold of Michael Bloomberg, maybe literally by the shirt collar, and say, what the hell are you doing? These are the guys who saved lives. These are the guys who risked everything. And they're not invited. Not only should they be invited, they should be given a place of honor.
The
ceremony should be about them.
And like Jimmy said, these are also the guys that were left behind.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's if anybody would like to talk about, you know, what you're doing now, like, I mean, we all work in our spare time on blogs and websites and podcasts. And so much of it stems from how we woke up that morning. I know that I consider myself a 9/11 conservative, a 9/11 Republican, and I get myself into all kinds of trouble by pointing out exactly who the enemy is, which we're no longer apparently allowed to do. Did any of the rest of you come to this point in time through that morning? Or were you always
I did in a certain sense. I was essentially raised as an apolitical person to think that, you know, pretty much all politicians are scum, which I guess is not too different from how I feel
not
now.
Not necessarily wrong.
Definitely that sort of prompted me to start paying attention to the world around me rather than my own little world. And honestly, there's one other thing that I have to say, because as I just said, I was apolitical and didn't really know what was going on. And so I did a bunch of research after 9/11, and I looked into the 9/11 conspiracy theories in depth. If you believe any of the conspiracy theories about 9/11, any of our listeners, stop. Yeah. They're wrong. This was done by Al-Qaeda. There is no two ways about it. Steel does melt.
Yeah.
And you need to do more research if you're still in that place. And that's, I guess, I'll leave it there.
Well, considering, you know, I had uncles that worked in smelters, Hamilton, Ontario, its whole job is to melt steel. Seeing that thing with the chicken wire and the kerosene, remember that video that went up on the internet? Made me angry. And I think a lot of us around the world got angry after September 11th and stayed that way. Whether or not that's healthy for us, it doesn't matter at this point. It's been a decade. We're still angry. And, you know, Jimmy said earlier, somebody has to pay for this. And we've had two wars now on two different battlefields, one in Afghanistan for almost this entire time since January of 2002, and in Iraq as well, and also little different places. I mean, we were very excited. We all came together a few months ago on May the 1st when Osama bin Laden was finally killed. He was killed in Pakistan. Not in Afghanistan, where we chased the Taliban, mm-hmm. not in Iraq, where we chased Saddam Hussein, not even in Dearborn, Michigan, where I thought he was driving a cab. So the fact of the matter is, some people got angry and stayed that way. I'm one of those people. This is a passion for me. This changed my life. And I will continue to make sure that the perpetrators are named and are pointed out among us. There have been studies saying that 1 in 5 Muslim Americans knows someone with sympathy toward terror. And I believe we talked about this last week on Brass Balls Radio. That's like saying, oh, I have a friend that visits prostitutes. You know what? If you're saying, oh, I know a guy, or oh, I have a friend, chances are it's you. So I have a feeling that 1 in 5 is a very conservative estimate. I have a
especially
feeling
since the there was a study done by the Center for Security Studies last year that said 4 out of 5 mosques in the U.S. preach a form of anti-Americanism and radicalism.
Yeah.
And by the way, that number is much higher overseas.
Exactly, oh, where it's being taught in the madrasas as a way of life. Hating America is a way of life. Hating America isn't just a way of life in Pakistan. It's a way of life in London. It's a way of life in Paris. It's a way of life here in Toronto. And not just for Muslims. We are taught to hate America every single day. You know, I don't buy into that. And Andrew doesn't buy into that. And, you know, our American friends are sitting down there going, why do you guys hate us so much? And Andrew and I are sitting here going, well, don't look at me, pal.
On that that New York Times map that I was talking about, and I would encourage everyone to put it there. I mean, it's quite spectacular. For example, I looked in and zoomed into Ground Zero, and there are some incredible testimonies from people that were there on 9/11. But what was amazing, and this ties into what you were just saying, Wendy, when I looked at some of the overseas comments that were left on there, some of the people, particularly India. India was, I think, the worst. There were a couple in Egypt. One person said something akin to the U.S. finally got what it was coming, got what was coming. Another person as well in India said they were unmoved because the U.S. has created much more terrorists than 9/11 was responsible for. And these are a few nut jobs. I'm not saying that they're people that reflect a general a general philosophy in the West, but it's a very real way of thinking. It's a very real philosophy that a lot of people do embrace, that this should have happened. And there were people dancing in the streets when this happened. We cannot forget that. Well, yes, there was on 9/11 a greater sense of unity in the United States and in Canada and in the Western world, a greater sense of unity than I think any other single event in recent memory has ever shown. But that doesn't mean that there weren't enemies. That doesn't mean that everyone was on our side that day. That's the biggest threat, and there still is a threat there.
There's one thing that I want to touch on really quick. I think it goes back to something we talked about on a previous Right This Way, where, Jimmy, you said we need to not define this as terrorism. And I think that's exactly right. I think this goes beyond terrorism, and it shouldn't be in the same ballpark as ELF and these other, you know, enviro terrorists. But I think, honestly, war is not an appropriate term for what Al-Qaeda has declared on us either, because that's one of the things that confused me when I first saw this. Not being politically aware, when they said this country is at war, I thought, in wars, you don't intentionally take out civilians. I mean, there was a nursery in one of these buildings, if I remember correctly. You don't intentionally take out nurseries in a war. So I think that's something else.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Dresden, you do. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. Here's the thing, guys. I don't care. I don't care who hates the United States. Don't care. What I care about is who hates the United States enough to try to act on their hate. I don't care if someone sits around and drinks beer and talks smack about me and my country all day. I don't care. Talk all the smack you want. I live in the richest, freest, most prosperous country on earth. The country that has brought more freedom and more prosperity to more human beings than any country that has ever existed in the history of humanity. Talk all the crap you want. The second you start sending people over to kill me and mine, I will punch you so hard your grandchildren grow up stunted. And that is the message. That's the message we need to continue to send. Hate America all you want. I don't care. You know something? That's people hate other countries. The second you start sending people over to kill us, whether it's our soldiers or our children, I will consider that war, and I will hit you just as hard as I can. And if you're dumb enough to hide around a bunch of other people, well, those other people need to know that my fist is big and I don't care where it lands.
You know, Jimmy, I get this a lot too, because I do tend to use broad strokes, and people will say, oh, well, you know, there are some good Muslims out there. And I said, you know what? When I was a kid, they tented our house and sprayed us because we had a problem with spiders. Pretty good chance they probably killed a few beautiful butterflies too. But do you really think I care? We had to get rid of those spiders.
You know something? I'm down with good Muslims. I know good Muslims. That's, you know something? Good Muslim, bad Muslim. It doesn't matter to me what kind of Muslim you are. Just don't be the kind of Muslim who decides that they want to strap on a bomb and come after me. Yeah. Because I don't care whether you're a country, and I get what, and you know something, I do understand what Ben's saying. From a practical definition sense of the word, it's really hard to call this a war. I personally stretch the definition large enough to cover it, because like him, I don't have a word for it. I don't have a better word for what this is, and I don't know how to put it in my head. The only thing I do know, and I think Ben and I are going to get down with it. Ben, we could come back in and either back me up or, you know, whip me with a stick. The thing where Ben and I are together on this is, whatever you call this, if you come over here and try to kill ours, we will hit you with the biggest hammer we've got. And I'm good with that.
And I'm actually going to take us out right there very quickly. With a reading from Romans 12:19. Vengeance is mine, I will repay. Keep that in mind. 10 years, September 11th. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for hanging out with the Take That Gang here on the Right This Way show. All wardrobes provided by DIY Industries. All weaponry is optional. The opinions expressed on this show most definitely reflect the views of this station and its management. Join us next week when we'll probably piss somebody else off. Hey, it's what we do. This has been a production of TakeThatRadio.com. Thanks for listening.